All right, welcome. My name is Alice Hill. I am Senior Director for Resilience Policy and Special Assistant to the President on the National Security Council. You know, when we were putting together this event, I frequently got the question, why does the National Security Council care about building codes? Fair question. We care about building codes because they work. Building codes save lives. As many of you know in this room, in 1915, if you were in a house fire, you stood a 1 in 10 chance of being killed. In 1976, the National Fire Protection Association passed the Life Safety Code, which led to code development across the nation requiring the installation of smoke detectors and alarms. Today, if you have that house fire, your chance of being killed is 1 in 200. In short, building codes have saved countless lives. We also know that in addition to saving lives, building codes prevent damage. In August 1992, Hurricane Andrew slammed into southern Florida. When it passed through Homestead, Florida, it basically wiped clean blocks of homes, leaving just the concrete foundations in place. Across Florida, some 177,000 people were left homeless, and strong winds caused almost all of that damage. As a result of the destruction caused by Andrew, the state of Florida established the Florida Building Codes Commission to assess building codes. And in 2001, Florida adopted a statewide building code which included new hurricane standards. When Hurricane Charley came through in 2004, that standard was tested, and the results were clear. More resilient standards meant a lot less damage. A study done after the hurricane found that modern building codes reduced the cost of insurance losses by 42% and the number of insured losses by 60%. In other words, Florida's ability to withstand disaster and get its businesses and communities up and running faster was directly tied to its building codes. Building codes and standards are the baseline for the safe design and construction of our home, our schools, and our workplaces. Now, when our codes and standards organizations, when we all develop standards and codes, we typically look to what has happened in the past to determine our risks in the future. We can no longer, however, solely rely on the past as our guide for the future. We must also consider the accelerating impacts of climate change. These impacts are already occurring, and they will increase in the future. We've experienced some of these impacts already. Hotter temperatures. You can't miss the headlines that we are having successively hotter years, year after year. More severe drought. In the western United States, we heard from folks suffering there, the worst drought in some cases in the past 1,200 years. More intense wildfires. Now, you can't always tie a particular event to climate change. The science isn't there yet. But certainly, we have seen extraordinary wildfire seasons. We have an extraordinary wildfire going on in Canada. Last year, over 10 million acres burned in the United States, setting records. If you think about that, that's about, I think, the size of Massachusetts and Rhode Island combined. And we also have experienced extreme precipitation events. If you talk to an emergency manager, they might use the term rain bombs. And that's because so much rain falls at once, we have an enormous challenge as to where that rain will go. And then if the land is already saturated, it becomes even more difficult. And we've certainly seen examples of that in the Carolinas last year, where in 5 days, enough rain fell to just about solve that 1,200-year drought in our western United States. And we saw it in Houston just this past month. So how can we ensure that the buildings that we built today, that they can perform well under these expected impacts from climate change? And how, when we choose to retrofit our buildings, can we make sure that they are resilient as well? We are learning that what has guided our decision choices in the past, average temperatures, return intervals of heavy precipitation events, and stationary sea levels can no longer safely guide us in our building choices. We need to build and design our buildings for the performance that we expect and require. We need to build them to withstand the hazards that we can reasonably expect over the life of the building. That means we have to take into account what's already occurring with climate change, so we can look to that past, but what is projected to occur in the future, because the impacts are going to become more powerful and they will accelerate despite our tremendous efforts to cut our carbon emissions. We've taken a number of steps here in the federal government to ensure that we are including resiliency in our federal infrastructure. In January 2015, we established a new federal flood risk management standard to improve the resilience of federal buildings and federally funded projects to the impacts of flooding. In February 2016, we established a federal earthquake risk management standard to improve the resilience and capability of federal buildings to function during and, importantly, after the earthquake. Because after all, when do our citizens most want us? After a disaster. And if we don't have functional buildings, it's difficult for us to play that crucial support role of making sure that they get their communities back up and running as quickly as possible. Many of those in the private sector are also taking steps to design buildings and go beyond minimum life safety requirements and incorporate the principles of resilient, performance-based design. There are also state and local governments who have been leaders in designing for resiliency. Well, each of these individual measures is significant. We recognize the need to institutionalize resilience more holistically across the country. And that's the focus of today's conference. We have a terrific lineup. I think you're going to be delighted to learn from the speakers that we have. They are knowledgeable, passionate, and truly are moving the discussion forward. You'll hear about activities that are already happening in the private sector to increase building resilience. You'll hear about the economic benefits of building resiliently and best practices for implementing resilient building codes at the state and local level. But before we get started, I do want to recognize our co-hosts. A topic like resilient building codes just cuts across a lot of different lines of business, including here at the White House. So we have a number of offices represented here today, and they have contributed greatly to bringing the focus to how do we make sure that we are building resiliently. I want to thank the Council on Environmental Quality, the National Economic Council, the Office of Science and Technology Policy, and the Office of Management and Budget for their support in planning this event. In addition, I also want to thank the National Institute of Building Sciences for their tremendous leadership in bringing together more than 40 stakeholders, organizations, to make resilience a top priority for the codes and standards community. Henry Green, president of the National Institute of Building Sciences, and Ryan Coker, director of the Consultative Council and presidential advisor, deserve our special recognition for their truly extraordinary efforts to put this event together. Thank you. So we have just a couple of housekeeping matters before we hear from our lead speaker. We'll take a break from 11 to 11:15 a.m. Please don't leave the building. You know, if you had a hard time getting in, you're going to have a really hard time if you've left getting back in. Restrooms, if you go out this door, turn right, and get back into the main court of the building, you'll find restrooms just right next to Ike's, our cafeteria. So we truly are delighted to have you here today. We're very excited about what we're going to learn with you. And to kick us off this morning, it's our honor to have Roy Wright with us. He is Deputy Associate Administrator for the Federal Insurance and Mitigation Administration at FEMA. Roy leads FEMA's risk management and risk reduction programs, and in that capacity, he leads the interagency work on developing our federal risk management standards. He's been a tremendous partner as we try to make sure that the federal government is mitigating risks in the choices it makes about its own infrastructure and its own assets. He is one of the government's most ardent advocates for reducing risk to communities by taking steps to prepare in advance to enable faster recovery from disasters. So please join me in giving him a very warm welcome. Thank you.
Good morning, everyone. And you found ways to mitigate the rain outside, and some of you even found ways to persevere to get in here. I am really privileged to be with you today, particularly given this topic. You know, for me, if you view this through this lens, if people are the lifeblood of a community, then buildings really are the foundation of a community. As I look at communities are about people, but people across this country live in communities and they're situated with a series of facilities and buildings. It's where we live, it's where we work, it's where we go to school, it's where we play. These elements are the foundation of what we do. So we take on this question of building codes. And what I love as I look across this room, some of you I know well, others that I've met for the first time today, we get this whole array of national leaders as well as state and locals. A summit like this on building codes has to have that kind of array. You see, under our federal system, it's really not quite as simple as saying we will mandate a code that will be used in every community across America. That's not how it works. And so we live in this kind of place by which, from the top, we can have a national policy conversation, we can drive incentives, we can lead by example, and we'll talk about more of those elements. But what I know is it is at a local community level and at a state level that these choices are made. Alice, in her introduction, referenced the Mitigation Framework Leadership Group that I chair. And it has been charged with taking on a piece of the national preparedness goal, which is to have a secure and resilient nation and ensure that we're building those capabilities to prevent, protect against, mitigate, respond to, and recover from the threats and hazards that pose the greatest risk. But in the direction that came to us under that presidential policy directive is we're standing up the piece for mitigation. One of the elements that is very distinctive about it is the role that state and locals play in it, so much so that when the Framework Leadership Group was stood up, it's the only one that has state and local membership on it. Because at the end of the day, these issues related to resilience and mitigation require all of those players to come together. So as I engage in conversations all across the country on these elements, just in California this past week on seismic issues, in Texas or Louisiana on flood issues in the couple of weeks that preceded it, I really understand it through two lanes. We have a built environment and we have a not yet built environment. And there is no silver bullet that solves for both. So, we've got more than 300 million people in this country that are situated in facilities, in structures that exist today. I live in a Sears bungalow in Arlington, Virginia. It was built in 1925. And I hazard to guess that the mothers and fathers of Arlington, Virginia didn't quite imagine that 91 years later we would still be using those same facilities, those same structures. And so there's a tremendous amount of work we have to do related to the built environment. Yet I am particularly focused on the next 50 million people and where they are going to be situated, because so much more is going to be built. And so I begin to ask questions, how can we achieve this broader goal of resiliency? Understanding that when disasters, we look at the natural hazard side particularly, hit communities, their ability to withstand and absorb or rebound quickly has a direct correlation to their local economy and the tax base by which they're going to be able to continue to exist. And so I look at this question and wonder, how can we better use the codes and standards? This practice that is becoming more prevalent across the country and has demonstrated its effectiveness, how can we use codes and standards to more effectively achieve these goals of resilience? Now, as mentioned, the kind of historical drive behind much of this. I spent a lot of time particularly on the flood and seismic dimensions of this, as well as some of the issues we do related to tornado and wind. And all of this is historically driven. So we got river gauges, we've got temperature, we've got 1% annual chance at 100 and 500 year events. And that information is very important, but it's not enough. We all know there's uncertainty in those models, and that uncertainty could very well begin to result in a way by which we actually are off by a foot or two. And we've told folks, if you build at this flood level, you'll be safe. Those of us who worked in this industry for a long time know we should never make that assertion, because safety is a much broader and more difficult question. But what does that look like? I was out in California at the National Earthquake Conference this past week, and you look back at the Napa event that took place last year, by which the codes that had been in place since the event of 2000. So the earthquake was very similar to the one we had seen 15 years earlier that had created a multiple of more than 10 times as much damage as this one did. What happened in the intervening time? The additional construction was built in a way that was compliant to meet those higher standards, as well as a good bit of retrofit work that has gone on. So I've talked about this kind of continuum. We got national policy, and we got those of you on the ground who really make this happen. And so we talk about things like the National Climate Assessment and what that looks like in terms of going into the future. I think the question for us in this room today is, how do we downscale that? How do we take that element related to what we understand that is happening related to sea level rise? But the place where we don't yet have enough data is in those riverine areas, where so much of the infrastructure in this country is likely to hit tipping points and fail. Fail in ways that don't just hit facilities and infrastructure, which is where the biggest cost will be, but will be hitting and affecting the lifeblood of communities. Those very people. We saw this as I was in Louisiana. Louisiana had a major flooding event in March. It was in the upstate area. They had not seen events even approaching this since the mid-90s. Interact with folks in communities, and they always says, well, I've lived here for X number of years. I've never seen it flood. This is a very common thing for me to hear. I'm very accustomed to hearing, I've been here for 17 years. I've never seen it flood. I've been here for 20 years. I've never seen it flood. I interact with family. It says, I've lived here for 53 years, and I haven't seen this flood. We're hitting these kinds of points by, yes, those intervals and those kind of exceedances happen. But folks that have been situated in such a way for 50 plus years are beginning to see those changes. Most of that flooding in March happened in less populated areas. We were just back down in Houston. Folks, this urban side of flooding is the piece that truly breaks the bank. It truly does. We look at the cost of Sandy, we look at the cost of Katrina, and we look at this kind of event that played out in Houston. There's a lot of great people in Houston. There's a lot of important industry in Houston. And there's an incredible amount of concrete that has covered a swamp in Houston. When you have people, concrete, swamp, and energy industry all coming together, you've got a recipe for a lot of difficulty. And we began to see those kind of elements. And while Harris County has done very good work related to new construction, most of the construction's been there for a long time. And they focus their new construction rules inside the area that we've designated for high hazard, which is all based historically. Yet we keep seeing the floods go farther and broader into those other areas. So as we look at these kind of changes and we look at the elements related to climate, what do those elements look like at an innovative scale to take these approaches at a state and local level? We can lead a conversation, we can put incentives in place at a national level, but the changes happen state by state and at that community scale. How do we raise those elements? How do we do it in a way that addresses social vulnerability? We look at some of the heat issues that have played out in Chicago in recent years. We look at the impact that has disproportionately on those of less means and wonder what are the adaptive pieces that we're putting in place to address this. And while most of our codes and standards focus on buildings, I look at the broader elements of infrastructure. That infrastructure is being used for far longer than its intended design life, and when it fails, it has cascading effects. Ultimately, we've got to position ourselves in a way that we can ensure the pieces that are there. So I look at larger scale facilities. We deal with state and local communities who tell us it's not insurable. It's not insurable. If it's not insurable, why are you using it? Well, we have to. We don't have any other choice. And so FEMA's put out some ideas right now related to a disaster deductible connected to the Stafford Act, particularly because we're looking at ways to drive state and local communities to make these investments on an ongoing basis, to buy down that risk. One of the elements that was included in that initial request for feedback from you all and across the public was, what does it mean to actually give credit for having state-level building codes in place? Because we know that for the future built environment, we can buy down that risk. So we've done the work related to flood executive order and seismic executive orders, very much focused on those federal facilities and the place where federal dollars are invested. But that, while important, is just an initial step. Because the sad reality for me is only 65% of the population in the United States today is covered by building codes. 80% of our population lives in urbanized areas. So sometimes it says, well, it's different in different parts of the country. The urban areas don't all have the building codes they need. And then we look at the elements related across other communities. The federal system really does place most of the responsibility for codes and standards on state and local communities. And so my hope today is that this dialogue across a couple of hundred people sets us in a way by which, whether we are building homes or building infrastructure, whether we're serving the public through social service agencies, or we're doing the enforcement of codes and standards, that the folks that are in this room help us identify what the next 10 years look like. Because this question of reducing risk transcends politics and it transcends administrations. This is about the life and safety of our people in this country. And collectively, we need to take this moment by which the White House is putting this emphasis and says, how do we continue to build on this in such a way that we are reducing the risk in this nation? We are reducing the cost and impact of disasters. Most importantly, so that the people who are the lifeblood of our communities can withstand the events that we know are coming and do so in a way by which they can rebound far more quickly and more fully. I think that's the challenge that sits in front of us today. How do we close that gap of the next 35% of the population? How do we put the right incentives in place? How do we leverage all of the work that has played out in recent decades, but to truly make a difference so that the people who live in these communities know that they will be able to raise their children and grandchildren in a way by which their way of life is something for which they're proud of and they want to see passed on from generation to generation. That is the charge that's in front of us. Thank you.
Okay, so I'm here to help moderate panel one. I'm Tammy Dickinson, the Principal Assistant Director for Energy and Environment at the Office of Science and Technology Policy. And I want to welcome all of you in the audience, as well as all of those on our live stream today for joining us, and all of my distinguished panelists. The first panel here is going to talk about the role of climate science and climate scientific information in planning for the built environment of the future. And I think we're going to have a very lively and constructive conversation. I wanted to start, though, by giving a little bit of context to frame our discussion today with some knowledge about climate change and its importance to building codes before I introduce our panelists and launch into the panel. As we know, the climate is changing. It's happening now, it's happening rapidly, and it's happening mostly because of human activities. And we are all experiencing the impacts of this. And as you can see from the quote on the slide here, this is from the third National Climate Assessment. So this is from U.S. federal and non-federal scientists. But this statement, I think, would be true. It's a consensus view of not only the U.S. scientist community, but the majority of the world's scientists and the world's governments. The climate, we know, has changed over the history of the Earth, but the current trend stands out is unprecedented both in speed and magnitude of change. And the basis for the human cause of the climate change is based on multiple lines of evidence. Human impacts are the only explanation that explains all of the lines of evidence. There's no natural explanation for them. The most significant cause is the emission of CO2 and other greenhouse gases into our atmosphere through industrial, transportation, and our energy sectors. CO2 and greenhouse gases trap long-wave radiation. They lead to the warming of the Earth's system, an array of important impacts. So you might ask, how do we know much about CO2? Well, we measure the CO2 concentrations in our atmosphere from the top of Mauna Loa volcano in Hawaii, and we've been doing so since 1958. And in 2015, they reported there were 400 parts per million of CO2 in our atmosphere. So this is very high. You might wonder, how do we know it's high? Well, the best way to look at CO2 concentrations in the past is to look at our ice core record, and we have ice cores going back about 800,000 years, and if you look at that record, you don't see anything close to 400 ppm. Most likely, we haven't seen 400 ppm CO2 concentrations in our atmosphere for millions of years. So those of you that remember 2014, it wasn't that long ago, it was a record temperature, global record temperature for warmth. For those of you that remember last year, it was even warmer. And it was warmer not by a little bit, but by a lot. And those of us experiencing this year, it looks like it's going to be on track to be even warmer. So 15 of the warmest years ever on record have occurred since 2015. And so when we look at every year being standing up here and saying, this is the warmest year ever, year after year after year, you know we're on a pretty big warming trend. And the warming accelerates, the sea level rise accelerates both to the expansion of the ocean and also to the melting of our ice sheets. And the rate of rise since 1992 has doubled. The rate of rise since 1992 has doubled what we saw before 1992. So the science community recognizes the importance of this type of information to planning for land use and infrastructure, or even home buying, and are developing models about sea level rise forecasts at a local scale so decision makers can use them to make their decisions. And a couple of good examples are NOAA's Sea Level Rise Viewer and Climate Central's Surge Sea Tool. Scientists are reporting and evaluating sea level rise for decades. The science is pretty well developed, but it's far from mature. And as conditions change, scientists learn new things that cause them to update and to improve their maps and forecasts. And I'm sure this is very frustrating for the users in the audience, but it is the nature of scientific progress. We use our best knowledge and best data and best tools at any particular time, but as we get more data, more knowledge, better tools, better models, we are continually updating our forecasts. It's only recently that scientists started looking at the connection between climate change and the increase in intensity and frequency of extreme events such as droughts, floods, hurricanes, hot and cold waves, wildfires, and all of their impacts on the built environment. The National Academy of Sciences found that the first attribution study of an extreme event to climate change was in 2004, and this was an analysis of the extreme heat wave in Europe in 2003. So within 8 years, by 2012, AMS, the American Meteorological Society, was devoting an entire issue of their annual journal to the connection between climate and extreme weather. So we've learned a lot about this topic in the last decade, both in content and in volume, and we're going to hear about some of that from our panelists today. But this is a new emphasis, and so the research is still developing and it's refining its methods. There's convergence on accurate and stable understandings will take time and resources. But the scientific community recognizes the practical importance of this work and the need for timely information, and our scientists are dedicated to making progress. So that brings me to introducing our three distinguished panelists today who will discuss how scientific information can develop better building codes for resilience to the types of extreme events that we will face in the future. Our first speaker panelist will be Dr. Jennifer Jacobs, a professor of civil and environmental engineering at the University of New Hampshire. She's an expert in remote sensing and hydrologic modeling, has published more than 50 journal articles, and she serves as director of the University of New Hampshire Environmental Research Group. Perhaps most important to today's panel, Jennifer is the principal investigator for an NSF project, Infrastructure and Climate Network, which is a group of 60 or more researchers, students, and practitioners committed to accelerating climate change research in the U.S. in order to enable more effective adaptation. Second will be Dr. Richard Wright, who up until his retirement served as professor of civil engineering at the University of Illinois and the director of NIST Building and Fire Research Lab. Dick is a member of the National Academy of Engineering and serves as the chairman of the National Academy's Board on Infrastructure and the Constructed Environment. And last but not least is Dr. Kenneth Conkle, senior scientist and science lead for assessments at NOAA Cooperative Institute of Climate and Satellites in Asheville, North Carolina. And he's also a research professor at North Carolina State University's Department of Marine, Earth, and Atmospheric Sciences. Ken has co-authored over 100 publications on climate variability and extreme event intensity, and was extensively involved in the development of the third National Climate Assessment, which I mentioned a moment ago. So Jennifer, could you lead us off, please?
Thank you, Dr. Dickinson, and good morning. Our built infrastructure is routinely put in harm's way from extreme weather, be it coastal and inland flooding, wildfires, strong winds from hurricanes and tornadoes, or extreme snow loads. The current practice in design codes is to look back to historical extreme events. With climate change, this approach is going to give us the wrong answer, and engineers don't like to be wrong. Dr. Dickinson gave us an excellent overview of the scientific consensus about climate change. The view comes from assessing the confidence and the skill of a really large body of scientific literature. And the thing that she didn't mention is that the result of this science is that the projected changes to extreme events have very clearly defined confidence levels. For some extremes, the observed trends are consistent with the basic physics, with the historical climate model simulations, and the future projections. In this case, we got a winning hand. We have high confidence in the future changes. For example, we have high confidence that the frequency and the magnitude of extreme heat events is increasing, and the risk of extreme cold is decreasing on average. The frequency of extreme precipitation is increasing across the mid-latitudes, with flooding risk in places like the Northeast, my backyard, increasing. In the Southwest, and more recently, the Southeast, the severity of drought is increasing due to warming temperatures, and the strongest hurricanes are becoming more frequent. In all these things, we have high confidence. In other cases, we have moderate confidence. We have moderate confidence that the mid-latitude storms will become more intense, that storm surges will get stronger, and that the wildfires in the West will become a greater concern. And truth be told, there's some cases where the jury is still out. The jury is still out on many of the small-scale extreme events that we care about, such as thunderstorms, tornadoes, and ice storms. Now, one of the most important messages from the National Climate Assessment is that the past is not a reliable indicator of the future. And so planning for our future based on the past in a changing, non-stationary climate is like driving down the road looking in the rearview mirror. Probably not a good idea. So we're going to be in trouble if we don't take our eyes off the past and start moving into the future. However, to date, we have not adequately developed the critically needed partnerships among our built infrastructure practitioners, our engineering researchers, and our climate scientists. There's a few models out there that work effectively. The Federal Highway has advanced climate and extreme event resiliency through their pilot projects. Our NSF-supported Infrastructure and Climate Network serves the transportation infrastructure sector in the northeastern U.S. And from the ICNET, we've learned a few things. We've learned that progress forward is not a one-way street. We found that our climate scientists underestimated our engineers' capacity and interest in understanding climate science methods. On the flip side, there was an overestimation about the current level of knowledge from engineers about climate change. Relatively few engineers know what climate data are available, and even fewer know how to use climate model findings in practice. We've also learned from the network that uncertainty in climate change is not outside of the engineering community's experience. Engineers are used to handling information that isn't perfect and still making it actionable. Building loads, seismic hazards, demographic changes are all examples of things where we have imperfect information. Climate research at this point can provide information about future extreme events, be it trends or numbers, which gives the engineering community the confidence to make smart choices based on infrastructure vulnerability. So in summary, we already know the types of extreme weather events that put our communities at risk. To make our buildings more resilient, we need to connect the dots between extreme weather, climate change, and impacts. Thank you.
Thank you, Jennifer. Dr. Wright, can you help us understand from the professional user's side how we deal with these issues?
As Professor Jacobs has described, we've learned that stationarity is dead, that the climate and weather extremes of the future are not well defined by those of the past. This is a challenge for the design community because the design loadings of our standards and codes are based on those historical records. Because of this issue, the American Society of Civil Engineers in 2011 established its Committee on Adaptation to a Changing Climate. The committee in 2015 published the report, Adapting Infrastructure and Civil Engineering Practice to a Changing Climate, and it's available free at the link shown on the slide. We thank the bureaucracy of the ASCE for making that report available free. Because of the great uncertainties of the magnitudes of future climate and weather extremes, the report recommends designing buildings and other infrastructure for appropriate future extremes and making them adaptable to more severe extremes if this is determined to be needed in the future. This can be called adaptive risk management. The observational method is well established in foundation engineering and can be extended to provide adaptive risk management over the entire service life of a building or other infrastructure facility. The observational method designs for an appropriate design basis estimate of the extremes likely to occur during the service life, but makes the building adaptable to maximum credible values of the extremes if observations during the service life show that this is needed. Note that the design basis certainly should not be less than that called for by current standards and codes, because as Professor Jacobs pointed out, the extremes are becoming more extreme across the board. An example would be to protect a building from flooding by designing for an appropriate ground floor elevation, but to provide space for building a berm around the site or elevating the building if greater flood levels become expected in the future. Now, I think this is going to really open up the place for ingenuity on the part of the design profession, to look for ways of making a particular building adaptable that are appropriate to the building use and appropriate to the neighborhood and appropriate to the site. One of the things we've said in our discussions about this approach is it's the end of handbook engineering. There's not some magic number that you can pull out of a book somewhere, put it into the computer, turn the crank, and out comes the answer. It's going to require ingenuity on the part of the designers in order to deal with this uncertainty. Now, this is also going to be a problem for our building codes and our standards. Research involving climate and weather scientists and engineers is needed to define the design basis and the maximum credible future extremes. And we're going to have to move to performance-based standards and codes in order to implement the adaptive risk management. And we've been moving towards performance-based standards and codes for many years, but we all know what a great challenge it is to implement it effectively, and climate change really puts this on the table for us. Thank you.
Thank you, Dick. So Ken, it's really great that the user community wants the science. How is the science community going to rise to meet that challenge?
Okay, well, thanks. I'm going to frame my remarks around a specific example of extreme, and that's heavy rainfall, which Professor Jacobs touched upon very briefly. That's been the focus of my own research. The graphic shows what's been happening with extreme rainfall, and it's been increasing steadily over the last few decades. Now, heavy rainfall design values, such as the 100-year storm, are widely used in the design of runoff control structures, among other applications. Climate scientists have high confidence that extreme heavy rainfall will increase in the future for very fundamental and unassailable scientific reasons. Climate models project this, but our confidence is based on much more than that. It's based on our fundamental understanding of the physical climate system. We can state with virtual certainty that current values, design values, based on just historical data, are underestimates of the actual future risk. In fact, current design values do not even fully reflect the recent increases that we've seen in heavy rain. In my opinion, we're in a new regime, and we should recognize that. Although there are uncertainties in the magnitude of future changes in these design values, I would ask whether that uncertainty should paralyze us into inaction, particularly when climate scientists know the direction of the change, which is towards greater risk. And I would say flatly no. What's needed is an acceptance of the high scientific consensus on this point and an immediate move by relevant organizations to develop a community consensus on how to incorporate this knowledge into rainfall design values, of course, always in the context of inherent uncertainties. Now, there are things that on which we do not have this high scientific consensus, as pointed out by Professor Jacobs and Dr. Wright. For instance, extreme wind speeds, particularly associated with tornadoes, that's an area that we just don't know the direction of change. But let's take action where we have high confidence. Now let me switch gears just very briefly and talk about a resource that's available, and that's the Climate Resilience Toolkit, in particular focus on sea level rise. One of the tools there is the Climate Explorer, and this is a tool where one can look at the neighborhood level, what the potential impacts are of various increments of sea level rise, and where one can, in a coastal area, find out if a particular area is at risk to what we think are reasonable projections of sea level rise over the next century. So thank you.
Thank you, Ken. Okay, so we have some time for a few questions and some discussion. So the first question, what lessons have you learned regarding making science more usable for the building community and or what do you think the building community could learn that would better enable them to use the science that's available? And I'll let all the panelists jump in at their will.
Can you?
No, I think you should. Okay.
I think it's going to be, we're hot. It's going to be very important for the building community to become working directly with the climate and weather science community, and also with the social scientists, the economists and the social scientists, in order to get the kind of information that will allow us to consider the cost and benefits of taking various levels of action to deal with the climate and weather risks. We also need to describe to the climate and weather scientists the kind of information we need in order to make design decisions. For instance, for many years, the Weather Service has not been very interested in the actual wind environment near the ground surface. They're seeking to predict the weather, so they're looking up at levels of about 1,000 meters above the ground surface for their modeling of the wind phenomena. But of course, when we want to protect our built environment against wind, we're very much concerned with what the wind is going to be at the ground level and what the effects will be of topography and other buildings in moderating of these wind effects. So we need a lot of very active dialogue between our building community, our financial community, and the people themselves working with the climate and weather scientists.
Jennifer, Ken, do either one of you want to add from the science point of view?
No.
So, second question, what does the practitioner community most need or crave in terms of scientific knowledge that the science community is not yet providing?
I'll take a crack at that. So, hands down, it's the design flood and the extreme rainfall information. Extreme rainfall and design flood are not the same thing. Sometimes they're very strongly related, and other times they're not so much. And this has been an area that I've been asked for the past 3, 4, 5 years from, and it's a bottoms up, it's a community base. There's community people that have seen the risks, they've seen the hazard, and they want to know what should they be doing to protect their communities in the future. And more recently, the states are also asking for the same information. The federal executive order that was mentioned earlier today, that's really accelerated that interest because now we're needing to build to a standard that we don't really know what those design values are. And so it's making this more urgent to have an understanding. So what's happening at that end is that we really are trying to move from flood control to flood risk management. From the scientific community, we have experts in the field that are looking at this challenge, and it's a tough nut. We have some individual communities and some states, like New York State, just came out with a statewide standard for how to handle the design events. But from the federal level, we do not yet have guidance coming out of the USGS or NOAA for some really good reasons. And we're not seeing that coming down the pike anytime in the near future. So this is something the communities really are craving and really need help with.
Yeah, and I've been approached by major U.S. cities for the same kind of information. How can I incorporate climate change considerations, future change, into rainfall design values? And these are people who are responsible for making decisions on billions of dollars of infrastructure. But we have no consensus on how to do that. I can provide an answer, but it's more of a, I would say, a one-off answer coming from a single person who's been working in the field for a long time. And it's it is a barrier to adoption or incorporation of these considerations. And we're talking about, you know, infrastructure that may last for 50 to 100 years, where it's very clear that the effects of climate change will be very important.
It was very interesting for me a couple of years ago to be in a discussion looking at the possible effects of climate change on the nation's capital here. And it was interesting that the emergency managers in the room were most concerned about the extreme heat waves because of the large number of casualties that have been observed in recent history in extreme heat waves. And of course, the necessity of mobilizing our whole society in order to protect the people who are most vulnerable at a time that extreme heat wave occurs.
So moving on, what do you think are the most important next steps, short term, medium term, long term? Who'd like to start? Ken?
I'll take a crack at that. Again, just framing my response around extreme rainfall, I think it's just, as I stated in my remarks, urgent that we take action now of some sort. So I think in the short term, we need some sort of community consensus involving federal agencies, agencies like the American Society of Civil Engineers and other relevant organizations, is what is a reasonable approach to take in the short term. In the longer term, there are projects, and I'm involved in one, to try to put this on a more systematic basis, to look at this problem of incorporating climate changes into rainfall design values. And I think we really need to move forward with that. At the same time, we can do this on a project level, but the involvement, again, of all the relevant organizations that have a stake in this would be highly beneficial in the long term.
I think a critical issue in the short term is the one that Professor Jacobs pointed out in the beginning. The design values in our current codes and standards do not adequately anticipate the effects of climate change. And we're making decisions every day, putting into concrete and steel and timber and masonry new buildings, new infrastructure. So in the short term, we very badly need a close collaboration between the climate and weather science community and the building community to get reasonable estimates to be used not in 2030, but to be used in 2017 of what we should be using for the extreme rainfall, for design of the drainage system, for the extreme temperatures, for the design of the heating, ventilating, and air conditioning system, the wind velocities, and all of those criteria that are in our codes and standards. So we really need to get together promptly in order to get off to a good start of what will be a decades-long process of improving our climate and weather models and continually improving those forecasts about what the extreme environments will be 50 and 100 years from now. Because this building that we're in right now was built in what, the 1870s? So you recognize those decisions that we make are going to be with us for a long period of time.
So great points. I think I'll add on that we've got some next steps. Dick had mentioned earlier that we've got a new generation of engineering. It's about risk management. It's not about the bottom line number. And so we need to transition there. So how do we do the things that were just mentioned? One of the things that we need to do, particularly with the building community, is to start the conversation. At our annual meetings, we need to have a climate change and extreme weather events sessions. At our committees in ASCE, this needs to be part of the conversation. It's not something different. This should be part of what we do on a business day to day. And over the near term, One of the things that we really need to be thinking about or that would make the work go smoother and faster is to develop regional engineering-specific focuses on climate information and impacts to the building sector. So not a broad-based sector, but discussions and groups that matter to the engineering community. And there's some great examples in other communities of regional focused efforts. The Department of Interior has got climate science centers, the USDA has got climate hubs, but we don't have anything similar to that for our built infrastructure. And I think that those models have worked extremely well in those communities. I think that would be a great next step.
So I think it's clear that there's some big challenges out here in this area, and I think it's also clear that we're going to need to improve the communication between the building community and the science community. And I think you've had some great ideas of how to start that. So hopefully we can get those to come to fruition. I want to thank all of you for your attention and thank the panelists for your input and your insights today.